Thank you for joining us tonight. We're in our Bible study on The Remnant Shall Return. We've been in this study for some time. JT talked last time about chapters 9, 10, 11, and 12. And so we're going to finish up Nehemiah tonight with chapter 13. We remember that as we talk about these Old Testament prophets, we're coming toward the end of those prophets. Haggai and Zechariah have already prophesied by this time, and only Malachi remains to be one who will prophesy in about 440 B.C. After that, we'll have about the 400 years of silence in between the Old Testament, the close of that, and the beginning of the New Testament. We've looked several times at the dates that are pertaining to the Medo-Persian Empire, because that's the empire we're talking about now. Babylon had been before it. Then you had the Assyrian before that. But after the Medo-Persian power, there's only the Grecian power and the Romans that come in the powers that are talked about in the book of Daniel. As the great image is seen, he pointed out to Babylon that you're the head of gold. He went down the rest, and then in that day when the kingdom would be set up, would be that iron and miry clay at the bottom, and that was, of course, the Roman Empire. But during the Medo-Persian Empire, it started as Cyrus conquered Babylon. We came down then and noticed some of these others. We're toward the end of this now in the Medo-Persian Empire during that time of Xerxes, as it's talked about, Darius the First's son. And so we get into the book of Nehemiah. We had talked about the first part of it was the reconstruction of the wall, a physical reconstruction work that needed to be done on the physical wall. But that second part that we have been looking at here for a little while is the restoration of the people. And that's a spiritual restoration that needed to take place. And we're down to this last part, the restoration of the people, after you had had Nehemiah try to do what was right in getting the people to do the will of God according to the law. There's going to come a time, as we're going to note tonight, that you have Nehemiah go away, goes back to Xerxes to be there to where he had originally come from. And then he's going to come back to Palestine, and we're going to see how the reforms and the restoration had survived while he was away. We start out by looking at Nehemiah chapter 13, verses 1 through 3. On that day they read from the book of Moses in the hearing of the people, and it was found written that no Ammonite or Moabite should ever come into the assembly of God, because they had not met the children of Israel with bread and water, but hired Balaam against them to curse them. However, our God turned the curse into a blessing, pardon me. So it was, when they had heard the law, that they separated all the mixed multitude from Israel. Of course, the part of the law that he's referring to is Deuteronomy chapter 23. Deuteronomy chapter 23, I want you to notice what he says. An Ammonite or a Moabite shall not enter the assembly of the Lord, even to the tenth generation of his descendants shall he enter the assembly of the Lord forever. You notice the point of that. To say even to the tenth generation, to the tenth meant coming to that full power. And then after that he says, no, not ever doing that. Never would they enter in forever. Now, contrast that with what you see of the Edomites. You shall not abhor an Edomite, for he is your brother. You recognize in the Old Testament law there were some that were to be abhorred, or as David said, I hate those whom you hate. That Edomite was not to be among them, because why? He's your brother. You had Esau there, Jacob and Esau, and they were brethren. And so they were not to put them out, but an Ammonite or Moabite, they were ones not of the brethren of the Israelite nation. They were ones who were opponents even from the coming out of Egypt, and they would not do them good, but tried to do them harm. And so Nehemiah, going back to that, had pointed out they're not to be there forever to come into the assembly of God. Why? Because they weren't those who met you with food. They met you with resistance. They met you with Balaam. You remember the point that is made there, that the Moabite king was going to ask to have Balaam to come and curse the people of Israel so that they would not be able to overcome his land. Well, God had made Balaam not to speak that which was a curse, but a blessing. And of course, the Moabite king was one who was furious at that. Well, he says, because of this, you do not have them in among you. And he says, so it was when they heard the law. In other words, what God had said back there in Deuteronomy 23, when they heard that, they separated all the mixed multitudes from Israel. Now, if you remember something about this study, is this the first time that we've come to this? Well, no, that's not the first time that we've come to this. You go back into the time of Ezra, and you see that they had not known the law, and they recognized they needed to put away those wives and children that were not of the children of Israel, that were part of the lands round about them. You go back before that, and you find out that they had intermarried, or they accepted some among them. And the result of that was they had turned to their gods, just as God had said. Indeed, the very point was, this is what happened with Solomon, and we'll notice that a little bit later. But they were to stay away from that. Not only had that been the point before the captivity into Babylon, that had been the captivity message as they came back from Ezra and Nehemiah. But not only had they been told that then, we're going to notice that they're going to again go back into the same thing as we're dealing now in this chapter with a time when you had Nehemiah go over to see the king and then come back in this time. Let's notice that. In Nehemiah chapter 13, in verse 4 beginning, now before this, Eliashib the priest, having authority over the storerooms of the house of our God, was allied with Tobiah. You remember he was one of the main ones who was enemies of the people when Nehemiah had come in. And he had prepared for him a large room where previously they had stored the grain offerings, the frankincense, the articles, the tithe of grain, the new wine and oil, which were commanded to be given to the Levites and singers and gatekeepers and the offerings for the priests. But during all of this, I was not in Jerusalem, for in the 32nd year of Artaxerxes, king of Babylon, I had returned to the king. Then, after certain days, I obtained leave from the king. Then, after certain days, I obtained leave from the king, and I came to Jerusalem and discovered the evil that Eliashib had done for Tobiah in preparing a room for him in the courts of the house of God. And it grieved me bitterly, therefore, I threw all the household goods of Tobiah out of the room. Then I commanded them to cleanse the rooms, and I brought back into them the articles of the house of God, with the grain offerings and the frankincense. Now, in this particular place, when Tobiah should have been seen as one who was part of the opposition, you remember him, he had been with Sanballat, Tobiah, and those who were there. They had been the ones who had been trying to hamper the building of the wall and all else that was going on. But now, after you have Nehemiah leave and go back to the king, here it was that Eliashib, the priest, who, you remember, had one of his children that was married into the family of Tobiah. Now Eliashib had provided for Tobiah to have a room, you might say to have an apartment within the house of God. This is exactly the opposite of what should have been done. Not only that, not only had he given Tobiah that place, but he had taken the things out of that room that should have been there to provide for those who were the Levites and those who were helping in the serving of the Lord. So just after you had had Nehemiah straighten everything out and get it properly done, now Elisha goes back and he does the exact opposite. But what does Nehemiah do? Nehemiah comes in and he throws that stuff of Tobiah out, and it says it grieved him bitterly. And because of that, he said he commanded that they clean out these rooms and that they again cleanse them from all of this. Now look what happens starting with verse 10. It says, I also realized that the portion for the Levites had not been given them, for each of the Levites and the singers who did the work had gone back to his field. So I contended with the rulers and said, why is the house of God forsaken? And I gathered them together and set them in their place. Then all Judah brought the tithe of the grain and new wine and the oil to the storehouse. And I appointed as treasurers over the storehouse Shelemiah the priest and Zadok the scribe and the Levites, Pedaiah. And next to them was Hanan, the son of Zakur, the son of Madanmiah, for they were considered faithful, and their task was to distribute their brethren. I probably should have done the same thing I told JT to do last week, and that was to skip all of those names and kind of mumble through them. But those difficult names we recognize. Notice what happens. The Levites are the ones who are not being given their portion. Now, what was commanded in the Old Testament law about that? They were commanded to receive the tithe offering, the various other things that were there, a part of the sacrifices that were made. They were commanded to receive this. Why? So they could be full-time attendants to the house of God. Nehemiah had set that up, as David had set it up before him. Ezra had talked about the need to do that. Various cases that you see in the Old Testament law where they tried to go back and do the will of God as they should have according to the law, they had to provide something for the Levites to be able to live. But what happens is Elisha doesn't give them that anymore. He throws that room away, gives it to Tobiah. And now what they had to do is they had to go back into their fields, it says. They had to go back into the fields. Not only the Levites, but the singers. Some of those who were the sons of Aaron also suffering the same thing, as we see time and time again throughout history. And the result of that is that there's something where the house of God is not tended to as it should be. And therefore, the full service and dedication and worship to God was not present the way that it should have been. So Nehemiah sets that all back up again, puts the people back over it, who should have been over it, and he gave them the task to distribute to their brethren. Now there's a refrain that keeps coming up in the 13th chapter of this, and it seems to be not the idea of Nehemiah calling attention to himself, but Nehemiah calling attention to the work that is to be done. He asks for God's blessing, not in a way of just caring about himself, but it's obvious that he's asking for a blessing that this work continue on. And he had done the best he could and asked for God's blessing. That's what you see in verse 14. Remember me, O God, concerning this, and do not wipe out my good deeds that I have done for the house of my God and for its services. In other words, the idea, he had gone and done this before. They had gone back in. Their service, not what it ought to be. He comes back and finds it. He again implements it. And what does he want? He'd want the same thing that you or I would want. If we went away, saw that the things that we had done for good were then put into a shambles, what would we ask for? That's the same thing, I'm convinced. To be those who would ask God for these good things, the services that were there that had been provided for that to go onward, and for God to remember that Nehemiah had done all that he could in this. Now let's go on in verse 15. It says, "In those days I saw people in Judah treading wine presses on the Sabbath, and bringing in sheaves, and loading donkeys with wine, grapes, figs, and all kinds of burdens, which they brought into Jerusalem on the Sabbath day. And I warned them about the day on which they were selling provisions. Men of Tyre dwelt there also, who brought in fish and all kinds of goods, and sold them on the Sabbath to the children of Judah and in Jerusalem. Then I contended with the nobles of Judah and said to them, 'What evil thing is this that you do, by which you profane the Sabbath day? Did not your fathers do thus? And did not our God bring all this disaster on us and on this city? Yet you bring added wrath on Israel by profaning the Sabbath.'" Notice what happens repeatedly through Israel's history. That is that we're going to go back to the same old things that were noticed all through the times of not only the kings, but going back to the judges and before. That after God had pronounced his will and he had said that you keep the Sabbath holy, you don't do any work on that. You do not have yourself engaged in commerce and all of these things. A great deal of regulation was given with respect to that. And yet what happens over and over again? They disregarded it. You know, it's obvious that when you come back from the captivity here into the land, that Israel does not again involve itself in idolatry. They were involved in that all through their history before the Babylonian captivity, but they did not involve themselves in that after they came back. That lesson was learned. But there's something that they continue to show, and that's a disdain for the law of God in anything that would cost them in a monetary sense. The keeping of the Sabbath day and all of the commerce that was not to be engaged in then. The remembering of the years of Jubilee, the Sabbath years that lie fallow in the land. And what do? They cannot keep themselves from the greed of needing or of wanting more and more and more. Well, what happens? What happens is after they come back, they're doing that again. And Nehemiah says, "Didn't you get the point? Did you not understand that when you did this before, that's one of the things that caused you to go in to the captivity that you received?" You see, it wasn't just the matter of idolatry. Yes, that was bad, and it was horrible in the sight of God. But other things were a problem as well. And many of these problems that Israel had, they kept repeating even after they had suffered the 70 years of captivity in Babylon. Look at the next paragraph in verse 19 beginning. "So it was at the gate of Jerusalem, as it began to be dark before the Sabbath, that I commanded the gates to be shut and charged that they must not be opened till after the Sabbath. Then I posted some of my servants at the gates, so that no burden would be brought in on the Sabbath day. Now the merchants and the sellers of all kinds of wares lodged outside Jerusalem once or twice. Then I warned them and said, 'Why do you spend the night around the wall? If you do so again, I will lay hands on you.' From that time on, they came no more on the Sabbath. And I commanded the Levites that they should cleanse themselves, and that they should go and guard the gates to sanctify the Sabbath day. Remember me," here's our refrain again, "remember me, O my God, concerning this also, and spare me according to the greatness of your mercy. What's he asking for? The point had been made in the previous paragraph that those who were the people of Tyre and Sidon, they came to trade in Jerusalem and in the land of Judah. And what were they told? They were told, no, you're not going to do that. That's against the law. So now what happens? They stay outside hoping that maybe Nehemiah would go away. I mean, he had before, and that's when they had been able to make this path in a previous time. But now, what he says is, once or twice, they stayed outside the gates waiting to get in on the Sabbath. And he told them, you don't do this anymore. If you do, I will lay hands on you. The idea is, I'll have you beaten. And that made the point. Nehemiah was making a stand, and he said, he was going to enforce this law that was of God. Now, who did he give to take that place and do it from that point on? I commanded the Levites that they should cleanse themselves. Obviously, the reason they needed to cleanse themselves, they had been permitting and possibly had been dealing on the Sabbath day as well. So they cleansed themselves, and that they go and guard the gate to sanctify the Sabbath day. There are two things I want to look at. First, on that idea, they went and guarded that place. You know, there's one thing to say, this cannot be done. This will not be allowed. But there's another thing that's to be done besides that, and that is to enforce that law. You remember back in the book of the Judges, we found out about the time in which people would do that which was right in their own eyes because there wasn't a king. You get into 1 Samuel and you see that Eli is the judge. His two sons are ones that act evil. And Eli warns them, what you do is not lawful. And he tells them that, and he condemns the action that they were doing that was unlawful of laying with the women before the house of the Lord. But the Old Testament tells us there that he restrained them not. And that's what God says to Samuel when he comes to him in that dream. He says to Samuel, I'm going to take Eli and his sons out of the way. They're going to be brought to death. Because he knew the evil that his sons had done and he did not restrain them. Parents, there's a point that's to be made. It's not enough for our children to know what the law of God is. And it's not enough for them to know what your individual rules are within the house. You need to go further and say, that's the rules and we are enforcing them. And that's what needs to happen. Same thing within a congregation of God's people. That the right has to be defended. And that there has to be a result for the doing of that which is wrong. That people need to do that which is right in the sight of God or know full well. That there are going to be those who are marked and withdrawn from. That there will be no fellowship with those who do that which is of evil. Restraining them is something on top of just making them know right. That's what Nehemiah does. And now what does he say? What he says to them is, oh God, remember me concerning this also and spare me according to the greatness of your mercy. They've done wrong, but remember, I tried to do that which was right. Let me talk about that second thing I said with regard to sanctifying the Sabbath day. He says to the Levites, you go out there and guard the gate to sanctify the Sabbath day. What does that mean? To sanctify means to set apart. What was the problem with an unsanctified Sabbath day? Well, they were coming in and practicing commerce, doing those things that God had said not to do. So now he says to the Levites, you keep that from happening so that what? You sanctify the Sabbath day. It wasn't just setting it apart in their minds as sanctified. It was to do what God said in keeping that law. And when they were ones who kept others from coming in to have commerce, and the people engaging in commerce themselves, what was the purpose of that? Because there's one thing that they needed to do to remember the Sabbath, to keep it holy and not let anything else take place then. Simple. So when God tells us to sanctify something in our life, like our lives morally, or that which is His truth, how is it we're to do that? It's not just a matter of being ones who in our heart have a sanctified kind of an attitude of piety towards God. There's more to it than that. There is that the opposite, that which would go against that truth or against that life of morality or whatever else is to be sanctified, that has to be defeated. And that's what we need to remember about the sanctity of God's people and of God's law and of morality and other things. Two elements that are in there involved. And that is that we affirmatively do what God says and negatively we keep the wrong from polluting that. That's how it is that you have the sanctification of that Sabbath day then. Well, let's look one more at Nehemiah chapter 13 and verse 23 beginning. In those days, I also saw Jews who had married women of Ashdod, Ammon, and Moab. And half of their children spoke the language of Ashdod and could not speak the language of Judah, but spoke according to the language of the one or the other people. So I contended with them and cursed them, struck some of them, and pulled out their hair and made them swear by God, saying, "You shall not give your daughters as wives to their sons, nor take their daughters for your sons or yourselves." Did not Solomon, king of Israel, sin by these things? Yet among many nations there was no king like him, who was believed of his God, and God made him king over all Israel. Nevertheless, pagan women caused even him to sin. Should we then hear of your doings, all this great evil, transgressing against our God by marrying pagan women? The point being made here, you've done exactly what God had told you not to do again. Ezra had told you not to do it. I had told you not to do it before that. But yet they kept slipping back into that pattern again and again and again. And what happens? He says to them, when Solomon did that, even Solomon sinned as a result of marrying these foreign women. Folks, think about that. Solomon was given wisdom beyond any man on earth, and yet that did not keep his will right before God. He knew what was wise. He had understanding of it. But just having understanding and wisdom does not give one the commitment and that strength to resist sin and to stand for right. Solomon failed to have that as he compromised with the wives of that he had that were of foreign nations and had their own false gods. The result of it was he sinned. And that's the result that you see that's going to be brought about for Israel again as they take women or they take the men who are of those nations round about and as a result go back into that path with them, a path that leads them away from the people of Israel. You also notice the problem that comes about with their children. Not only are they influenced by these foreign women, but their children are like that. Now what do? They spoke in the language of Ashdod or Ammon, and they could not speak the language of Judah, Hebrew. They could not speak that. Why? Because they had been so influenced. You know what? It's one thing when we go and involve ourselves with those of the world. But when our children notice that, and that becomes their habit of seeing that, then what's going to take place? Then those children aren't going to know what the grandparents knew and what they stood for. What they're going to know is that their parents had changed that path and they did that. And now what happens? The next generation just gets worse from that. While maybe those, or certainly those grandparents knew Hebrew, they could have spoken, and their children. But now that next generation is so saturated with the things of the people of the land that they don't even know the language of God's people anymore. In that last paragraph of verse 28 beginning, it says, "And one of the sons of Jehoiada, the son of Eliashib, the high priest, was a son-in-law of Sanballat the Horonite. Therefore I drove him from me. Remember them, O my God, because they have defiled the priesthood and the covenant of the priesthood and the Levites. Thus I cleansed them of everything pagan. I also assigned duties to the priests and the Levites, each to his service, and to bringing the wood offering and the first fruits at appointed times." Here's our refrain: "Remember me, O God, for good." What had happened here? Look at what it says. One of the priests, the high priest, Eliashib, one of his sons was a son-in-law to Sanballat the Horonite. Now, who was he? He was one of the same ones mentioned with regard to Tobiah and the others who had opposed the people of God. And now what happens? He joins with the high priest family. You know, the problem many times is that those who are reputed to be something turn out to be traitors to the cause of God. That's happened over and over again. You see that in Old Testament history. You see that sometimes in New Testament history. And when you notice that those who have stood for truth before now lead in a way that's toward error, it has a greater impact and emphasis on that. We need to remember that our commitment must always be to the law of God, to His will. It is not to some group of people in some college or paper or whatever else it might be. When we get ourselves to be allied with those on those kind of terms, we forget where our commitment needs to be. Our commitment needs to be to the Word of God. That and that alone is how God teaches His will. That and that alone is how God intends to sanctify us and to make us free. It's by His Word. And when we leave that Word and we follow men, however much they may have been committed to truth before, then you know what happens? What happens is we follow men into their way of error. Every man has a tendency that is out there towards his own desires, his own pride. I didn't say he's affected by that as sin and being born in it. But there is that tendency to go after the things that he wants and what he feels best. That must always be kept in check by going back to the will of God and seeing what it says. Many times I've seen those of my own brethren who are older, who were to me great men of being mentors, being good examples. And with every single one of them I knew in my life, I remember them making this point: don't give your allegiance to men or the alliances of men or the organizations of men. Give your commitment to God and His Word. And that will check our lives and keep us sure in the way that we should go. Well, I appreciate your good attention this evening and being with me for this time. Next week, the Lord willing, we're going to start the book of Malachi. That is on A Remnant Shall Return, pages 110 to 114. So if you want to read ahead in that, we'll look at that. Probably take a couple of weeks in the book of Malachi, and then have another lesson on the years of silence, the 400 years of silence. Thank you again for being with us. May God bless you. Good night.